All right, let's begin the reading of today's Boston Globe on the Talking Information Center. For today, it's Wednesday, the 10th of June, 2026, and we say hello to Karen and Pamela.
Good morning, this is Pamela.
And Karen.
And from the front page, a family on the brink. For Luceni, Jean, and Marcus and Gilles, it's a question on their minds all the time when their sons leave for school in the morning while Gilles works his overnight shift after Jean puts the children to bed. Will the Supreme Court let the Trump administration end the humanitarian program that has allowed them to build their lives here? They know the decision, expected in the next month or so, will change their lives irrevocably. We are stressed. We wait. We hope for something good to happen, Gilles said in French. The couple, who live in Jamaica playing with their three children, are able to lawfully reside and work in the United States because of the temporary protected status program for Haitians. Some 330,000 Haitians across the country are living here legally under the program, which was created to help people from countries undergoing violent conflict, environmental catastrophes, or other dangerous conditions, and shields them from deportation. It was opened to Haitians after the earthquake that devastated the country in 2010. But the Trump administration is fighting to terminate TPS, which it says was never meant to be permanent, and the issue is now before the Supreme Court. During oral arguments in April, the Justice Department asserted that it was squarely within the administration's power to end the program, and that courts could not take that authority away. Attorneys for Haitians argued that the Trump administration's decision to cancel TPS was motivated by racial animus towards non-white immigrants and bare dislike of Haitians. The justices, who appeared dividing during questioning, will issue a ruling sometime this month or in early July. For Gilles and Jean, who have lived in the United States since 2022, losing their legal status would lead to the loss of everything they've worked for since 2014, when Gilles first left Haiti in hopes of escaping poverty and violence in the north of the country. I have a lot of dreams, to have legal documents, to work, to learn something professionally, but that depends on what the government will grant us, Jean, 35, said in Haitian Creole, with her husband translating into French. One day, she hopes to become a nurse here. For now, her husband sustains the family financially and for several years has worked at a long-term care facility serving mostly elderly patients in Boston. They cannot return to Haiti, they say. Armed conflict and gang violence have only worsened since they left, particularly since the 2021 assassination of the country's president, Jovenel Moïse. Haiti's economic conditions are deteriorating, too. Their relatives who remain in the country sometimes do not have enough money to eat, Gilles said. So the family is grasping for alternatives. They're saving money in case they decide to return to Brazil, where they spent about 5 years before coming to the United States. But they would have to start from scratch again without housing or family to help. If their immigration status in the United States is suddenly revoked, they fear they may have no choice but to stay here at least for a short time without any legal safeguards. In that case, Gilles and Jean could be detained and separated from their children, or the family could be arrested, detained, and deported together. If you don't have a status, and they are waiting for you and targeting you, it's going to be hard, Gilles, 38, said. In the meantime, they continued their daily routine. Gilles commutes to his job housekeeping at the facility in Rosendale, sometimes working overnight shifts, cleaning the bathrooms and patient rooms. When his shift is over, he takes his 9-year-old son, Owen, to school. Jean shuttles their 18-month-old daughter, Curly, who has significant developmental delays because she was born 3 months premature, to her various medical appointments, including occupational therapy, several times a week. Their 17-year-old son, Mark Turson, is self-sufficient high school junior who hopes to study computer science in college after he graduates, his father said. If he loses his status, it's unclear if he'll be able to graduate from high school in the United States or go to college here like he'd hoped. He loves this country, Gilles said. One morning last week, he held Owen's hand as they walked their car. These were Owen's last few weeks of fourth grade, maybe his last in the Boston public school system. In his time here, he has swiftly learned English, discovered a love for science class, and relished soccer games in school. The boy dreams of becoming a police officer. Because, he said, I want to protect people. Owen is shy, but he has formed close bonds with his classmates. On his way to school, he skipped ahead of his father as a crossing guard, helped him across the street, running up to a group of kids gathered on the front steps of his school in Mattapan. Gilles watched his son from across the street. "He has a lot of friends," Gilles said with a grin. "Let's try and see if they will give us the opportunity to stay." They had risked their lives to get here. Gilles made an early foray in 2016, hoping to build life here and eventually bring his family over. With no networks, though, he missed his wife and sons and soon returned to Brazil. But the family struggled to sustain themselves in Brazil and saw scant opportunity for upward economic mobility. Gilles worked at a supermarket, and Jean worked in meat processing. So they decided to try the United States again, together this time, taking buses and trains and trekking miles on foot through Central America and Mexico. The scariest part, the family recalls, was crossing the Darien Gap, a dense jungle passage connecting Colombia and Panama, known for its torrential rivers, dangerous animals, and armed bandits who target migrants. Owen, who was then 5, remembers how bruised his legs became after days of trudging through the treacherous terrain. His dad carried him as much as he could. The family crossed about a half a dozen countries to arrive at the U.S.-Mexico border in the city of Reynosa, where they lived in a shelter for 6 months as they waited for permission to enter the United States legally. Finally, in May 2022, U.S. border officials allowed the family to enter, and they were given an immigration court date for 2028, where they would appear in front of a judge and request to remain, likely under asylum. Eventually, the family settled in Boston and secured their temporary protected status. A few years later, Curly was born here. So early, she was treated in the neonatal intensive care unit at Tufts Medical Center for 3 months before the family was allowed to bring her home. Now, she's finally getting stronger, eating more, and has a trustworthy medical team in Boston who monitor closely. "She's making progress," Gilles added, as the toddler grasped their living room furniture, pulling herself up to standing. What would happen to this daughter, a U.S. citizen, if they are forced to leave? It's one of his biggest worries. For now, he's holding on to the hope they're finally home. Karen?
Thanks, Pamela. And also from today's front page, pushback slows town's efforts to phase out nicotine sales. In the nearly 5 years since Brookline put a lifetime ban on nicotine and tobacco sales for young adults, similar policies have spread to roughly 24 other Massachusetts communities. But support is waning. Local health boards are increasingly foregoing efforts to enact similar nicotine-free generation regulations, policies that prohibit people born after a certain date from ever purchasing cigarettes and other nicotine products, regardless of their age. While more cities and towns than ever have fielded regulatory proposals this year, most have punted on the issue as they wait to see whether the movement can build more steam regionally and among state lawmakers. Pushback from the tobacco and convenience store industries has also mounted, with local business owners packing health board meetings to oppose the regulations. "So far, the resistance is working," said Bob Collette, director of Barnstable County's Tobacco Control Program, where birth date ban initiatives have increasingly become a, quote, difficult sell. "A strong tobacco lobby is doing a great job at instilling fear in the retailers around adopting this particular initiative," he said. Headed by a coalition of Boston area academics and health experts, the nicotine-free movement has yet to reach the widespread adoption that advocates say they'll need to achieve their goal of phasing out nicotine use for future generations, starting with Gen Z. Now, it also faces a mortal threat with two industry-supported bills pending in the legislature that would repeal all generational bans and strip health boards of authority to approve them, said Mark Gottlieb, director of Northeastern University's Public Health Advocacy Institute and one of the architects of the generational initiatives. Enacted as a first-in-the-nation policy by Brookline in 2021, the bans outlaw any purchase of cigarettes, vapes, pouches, and other nicotine products for people after a given birth date. Regulations with cutoffs between 2000 and 2006 have been adopted by 24 cities and towns across the state, from Needham, Newton, and Somerville to Amherst and Northampton, whose enforcement will kick in this summer. The goal, Gottlieb said, was for roughly a dozen communities to adopt proposals each year. If we're not doing that, it will be a sign that we're losing some momentum on this policy, and maybe other policies should be considered instead, he added. So far this year, just three municipalities have added permanent bans tied to birthdays, while more than a dozen have postponed or declined discussions. Barnstable voted against a regulation proposal in March. Similar nicotine regulation efforts have failed to launch across Cape Cod, a key testing ground for previous tobacco control efforts like smoke-free restaurants in the early 2000s. Daniel Lutzkow, a member of the Barnstable's Board of Health, said his agency received 100% negative community feedback from retailers, fearing an economic hit, and residents who said the policy violates basic freedoms. He also questions advocates' tactics of pushing the measures through appointed boards of health rather than having them passed into law by elected city and town councils. To me, this felt more like it was passing a new law, he said. We felt like bringing it to the Board of Health was bypassing the democratic process. The goal, supporters say, is gradually phasing out tobacco usage by placing more separation between the products, the number one driver of preventable death nationwide, and people in their teenage and young adult years, ages when most chronic smokers begin their use, according to the Food and Drug Administration. Industry groups also say it overreaches by allowing local boards of health to pass such sweeping bans, and that the move could spur an illicit market. Across the 24 nicotine-free municipalities, nearly half of the approvals came from health boards that were appointed rather than elected by voters. They should take it up at the state level so that at least every business in Massachusetts is on the same legal footing, said Peter Brennan, executive director of the New England Convenience Store and Energy Marketers Association, a trade group that is one of the initiative's staunchest opponents. In Bellingham, the only town besides Brookline to put the issue directly before voters, the measure was shot down decisively at a 2025 town meeting. Newton passed regulations last year by city council vote, while Worcester City Council declined to pursue a similar proposal in 2024. The policies haven't been adopted in other states, though the United Kingdom passed similar regulations on cigarettes in April based on Massachusetts' model. Last year, lawmakers considered a proposal to adopt statewide generational nicotine restrictions, but the bill gained little support on Beacon Hill and was shelved, said Catherine Silbaugh, a Boston University law professor and anti-tobacco movement leader. It wasn't going to go anywhere until more towns and cities passed it, said Silbaugh. It will likely take between 50 and 100 adopters across the state to move that needle, added Anthony Ishak, a pharmacist who co-sponsored Brookline's regulation. A similar bill was recently introduced in New York State Legislature. For Silbaugh, precisely the political insulation from inappropriate influences, such as commercial industries, is what allows local health boards to undertake ambitious new policies and build the broad support necessary for a statewide campaign. Yet, increasingly, some board members said they feel pressure from businesses and community members to oppose nicotine-free generation regulations. Lawrence Venezia, a member of Yarmouth's Board of Health, said he strongly supports the regulations from a public health perspective. Nonetheless, he proposed that the board postpone any decision for a year or more after local business owners packed a May 4th meeting to protest the measure. We're getting so much pushback from the local business community that I'm inclined to just table the whole plan at this point, Venezia said. Pamela?
Thanks, Karen. Ebola deaths rise in Congo. More than 100 people have died from Ebola less than a month after authorities declared an outbreak of the disease in eastern Congo, a grim toll as officials intensify efforts to slow the disease discovered weeks late. attacks on health workers from angry residents, skepticism among some locals, and armed conflict in hotspots continue to challenge efforts to stop the Ebola outbreak declared on May 15th, caused by a severe form of the disease. Out of the 550 cases confirmed as of Sunday, there have been 101 deaths and 19 recoveries, the latest situation report said late Monday. The outbreak is concentrated in Congo's eastern province of Ituri, which accounts for more than 90% of the cases. Cases have also been recorded in North Kivu and South Kivu provinces and have spread across the border to Uganda. However, the number of cases in Congo is believed to be higher because the outbreak was confirmed weeks late and the contact tracing coverage rate, which has improved in recent days, is still at 64%. The World Health Organization said Tuesday that over the last 24 hours, only 137 samples have been tested, with 35 coming back positive. The latest Ebola outbreak is caused by the rare Bundibugyo virus, which does not have an approved vaccine or treatment, unlike the Zaire virus, another name for the Ebola virus, responsible for most of Congo's past 16 outbreaks of the disease. The rapid increase in the number of cases is partly due to the scale-up of diagnostic capacities, enabling testing of the backlog of previously collected samples, authorities said. Health measures put in place to limit the spread of Ebola have disrupted daily life in Bunia, the bustling capital of Ituri province. There's still widespread skepticism and disregard for health protocols in some parts of the province. Survivors of Congo's 2018 Ebola outbreak, the second biggest in history, have warned that a repeat of past mistakes could lead to a high number of preventable deaths. Frontline health workers, who labor with little pay or rest, have been attacked multiple times by angry residents and have been unable to reach some communities cut off by conflict involving armed rebels. Eastern Congo has for years seen attacks by dozens of separate rebel and militant groups, some of them with links to foreign countries or the extremist Islamic State group. Since the outbreak was declared in mid-May, more than 520 incidents impacting the work of health professionals have been reported, according to Marie Roselyne Darnica Belizaire, who's emergency director for Africa. She does not elaborate on the incidents or say where anyone was hurt. The fighting is disrupting surveillance and response activities and increasing the risk of undetected transmission, WHO said Monday. Such incidents underline the challenges of the context and the importance of working closely with local leaders and communities. Nearly a million people have been displaced by conflict in Ituri, according to the UN Humanitarian Office, making contact tracing difficult as people flee attacks or move frequently in the vast province with dense forests, poor roads, and remote villages that can take days to reach. Tracing also is difficult among the thousands of artisanal miners who regularly move between remote sites in the mineral-rich region. WHO currently assesses the risk of spread for the rest of Africa and at the global level as low. Ebola patients can recover if they get the medical support they need, WHO Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said Monday during a visit to Uganda. On Tuesday, Kenyan police fired tear gas to disperse protesters in the town of Nanyuki, near military air base, where the United States plans to build an Ebola quarantine center, a project that has since drawn protests but was later halted by the courts. A heavy deployment of riot and regular police prevented the protesters from marching toward the base. Karen?
Thanks, Pamela. Our next article on health news comes to us from the New York Times. Study: health risks of alcohol increase after one drink a day. Report differs from one with ties to industry. A government alcohol study published Tuesday concluded that the health risks of alcohol start at a single drink a day. The report was caught up in controversy after drawing the ire of the alcohol industry. At one drink a day, the researchers found there was an increased risk of premature death from all illness or injury directly attributable to alcohol, though it was small, 1 in 1,000 people. But the risk of premature death jumped to 1 in 25 for those who had two drinks a day, a level long considered safe for men, according to the study, which was published in the Journal of Studies on Alcohol and Drugs. The alcohol intake and health study was one of two reports commissioned during the Biden administration to inform an update to the U.S. dietary guidelines. The second report, from a panel appointed by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, or NASEM, came to very different conclusions. It suggested moderate drinking was healthier than not drinking at all, although it noted that moderate drinking was also linked to a higher breast cancer risk. Some of the panelists behind that report had financial ties to the alcohol industry. The second report's finding was more palatable to the alcohol industry, which had called the alcohol intake and health study ideologically driven and scientifically flawed, and said it had communicated its concerns repeatedly to government officials over a period of several years. When the Trump administration finally issued the new dietary guidelines in January, they advised Americans to drink less for better health, but omitted any recommendation for daily limits in a departure from previous years. The new dietary guidelines say that consuming less is better for your health, but don't say what consuming less means, said Priscilla Martinez Matichek, one of the authors of the new paper and the deputy scientific director of the alcohol research group at the nonprofit Public Health Institute. This paper does, and it says that having no more than one drink a day is best for health, and that drinking above that comes with significant risks. In an editorial accompanying the new paper, Robert M. Vincent, the former government official who commissioned the study, said he believed he was fired because the report produced evidence at odds with commercial interests. Vincent lost his job as associate administrator for alcohol prevention and treatment policy at the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration during a reduction in force last year. A spokesperson for the Department of Health and Human Services did not respond to a request for comment about Vincent's statement. The new study, which relied exclusively on U.S. health data, assessed relationships between average alcohol consumption and the risk of disease or death from causes that were directly attributed to drinking. Women who had one drink a day were more likely to die of liver cancer or breast cancer than women who did not drink. And at one drink a day, both men and women were at increased risk of dying from liver cirrhosis, oral and esophageal cancers, and injuries, the paper found. The risks continue to climb with higher levels of consumption. Consuming more than one drink per occasion was associated with progressively higher risks of breast cancer, cardiovascular disease, and injury. Dr. Ned Collange, an epidemiologist at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus, who led the NASEM study, said he stood by its conclusions. Alcohol research is complex, and I am not surprised by different methods producing different results, Collange said. At the same time, he added, I don't believe anyone should start drinking for health reasons.
Woman set to swim the entire length of California coast. Perils are many, but she hopes to raise awareness. Early one morning next month, Catherine Breed, 33, will walk into the ocean just north of the California-Oregon border and start swimming south. Between 80 and 126 days later, if things go as planned, she'll reach the California-Mexico border, becoming the first person to swim the entire length of California. To attain this audacious goal, she'll have to swim about 900 miles along rugged coastline in the open Pacific, vulnerable to great white sharks, elephant seals, venomous jellyfish, storms, currents, hypothermia, and rhabdomyolysis, a dangerous condition in which muscles disintegrate from overexertion. Like a lunar mission, Breed's expedition, called Swim California, has a flexible, weather-dependent launch date. Breed and a crew of four will eat, sleep, and live aboard a 52-foot sailboat, sheltering at night in coves and harbors when possible. Except on periodic rest days, she will swim for 5 to 8 hours each day, starting where she stopped the previous day. On clear, calm days with a neutral current, she'll cover 10 to 15 miles. To have the swim ratified by the World Open Water Swimming Association, the crew will upload a daily observer's log that records air and water temperature, wind speed and direction, breed stroke rate, wildlife incidents, and geotag photos for every 30 minutes she's in the water. In Breed's day job at Intuitive Surgical, which she will quit to make the swim, she trains doctors to use a robotic surgical system. One of these physicians is Dr. Jonathan Carter, who's acting as a consulting physician for Swim California. In addition to her full-time job, each week Breed lifts weights three times, swims roughly 40,000 yards, more than 22 miles, and spearheads logistical planning for her expedition. "Yeah, long days," she said. "I'm not having any crazy meltdowns, but I definitely have moments." She paused. "You know when you see a frayed power line? That's how I feel on the inside sometimes." Breed likes to describe Swim California in the first person plural. Not "I'm swimming California," but "we're swimming California." In addition to Carter, her support team includes an athletic trainer, a nutritionist, a lawyer, a fundraiser, a publicist, a logistics coordinator, a kayaker, and a boat pilot who has circumnavigated the world. Her boyfriend, Dave Monticello, will shadow the boat's southward progress in a sprinter van, resupplying the crew at sea with supplies. At a dozen key locations, Breed will come ashore for public education events meant to raise money for ocean conservation issues. "When I get to think about it, it's such a big, stressful thing," she said. "But I'm also like, I get to take 4 months where all I really have to do is put my face in the ocean for 5 hours a day and then hang out on a boat. Like, that's not the worst way to spend 4 months." Breed held a fundraising event at the private 166-year-old Olympic Club in downtown San Francisco. Those present were from a wide range of ages, including seniors and elementary schoolers. Breed walked the audience through some basics of her biography. She was born and raised in the Bay Area, and her childhood was full of swimming and sailing. She got a scholarship to swim at the University of California, Berkeley, where she was a pre-med major, a two-time All-American swimmer, and a member of the U.S. national team. Instead of pursuing medical school, she decided she would make her impact as a swimmer. Breed's expedition is surrounded by questions like, how much does it cost? Around $500,000 from individual donors and corporate sponsors. What she will eat for breakfast? Chia pudding, overnight oats. Whether they can join her for part of the swim? No. And if she'll be posting and live streaming any of the swim? Yes, on Instagram and YouTube. But perhaps the two most common questions are, why are you doing this? And what about the sharks? Breed described multiple motives: to promote ocean conservation, to inspire others, to set a record, to have an extraordinary adventure. During Swim California, Breed will wear a small device that creates a magnetic field meant to confuse a shark's sensory system. Someone in a kayak or small boat will always be near her, and at known hot spots, multiple scanners will watch for sharks and sea life.
Well, that's good. And our next news briefs come from today's Political Notebook. Social Security at risk for cuts by 32, report says. Dateline Washington. The financial forecast for Social Security worsened this year, according to the annual financial report released Tuesday by the program's trustees. If Congress does not develop a plan to shore up the program, it would need to cut benefits for millions of Americans in just a little more than 6 years. Social Security's deteriorating finances have long been thought of as a future problem for another president or another Congress to resolve. But now, it is creeping ever closer because funds will run out before the end of the next president's term. The Social Security Old Age and Survivors Insurance Trust Fund, which helps pay retiree and survivor benefits to more than 68 million beneficiaries, is now expected to run out of money at the end of 2032, one quarter earlier than projected last year. That means incoming revenue would be enough to pay only 78% of benefits, in other words, a reduction of 22%, according to the report. But that situation would come to fruition only if lawmakers don't act to strengthen the program before then, through some combination of higher taxes or reduced checks. Medicare's Hospital Trust Fund is expected to run out of money in 2033, slightly earlier in the same year as the trustees had estimated last year. In the second quarter of that year, Medicare is projected to have only enough money to pay 89% of the program's hospital bills. Social Security has long faced a financing shortfall, but it has worsened in the short term for several reasons. The trustees assumed that fertility and immigration rates would be lower, posing a drag on the program, and the trust fund will collect less tax revenue from Social Security beneficiaries because of the big tax and policy bill passed last summer. The trustees also assumed that workers' earnings would grow faster, helping the program's finances. Social Security must also confront its more long-standing challenges. Dwindling birth rates mean fewer workers are paying taxes into the program, all while thousands of baby boomers are retiring daily and collecting their benefits for longer periods. The next article is Trump to ask justices to review his suit against CNN. President Trump told the U.S. Supreme Court he intends to ask the justices to revive his $475 million defamation lawsuit against CNN over use of the term big lie in reporting on his claim that the 2020 election was rigged against him. Trump's lawyers asked the Supreme Court for a 60-day extension to August 15th to file his petition for review of a lower court's dismissal of the case, according to a request that was formally docketed by the justices on Friday. The filing, the first sign that Trump would seek to revive the suit, indicated his appeal would double down on his claims about the 2020 election. In reality, President Trump was lawfully pursuing then unresolved and now proven claims about election irregularities in the 2020 presidential election, Trump attorney Alejandro Brito said in the filing. The case is one of several Trump has filed against the media in recent years, including multi-billion dollar suits against the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and the British Broadcasting Corporation. The cases broadly accuse the outlets of publishing false claims about Trump's conduct and finances, leading to allegations that he is trying to silence media criticism. Trump sued CNN in 2022, accusing the network of smearing him by frequently using the term big lie to describe his unsubstantiated theory that Joe Biden's victory in the 2020 election was the result of massive voter fraud. And the next article is, Hilton will face Becerra in California gubernatorial election. Republican Steve Hilton advanced to the general election for California governor after making the case that the state desperately needs new leadership following more than 15 years of Democratic dominance. He'll face Democrat Xavier Becerra, a former state attorney general and Biden administration health secretary, whom the Associated Press previously determined had won enough votes. Hilton faces a challenging electorate in the November election, as California has nearly twice as many registered Democrats as Republicans. If elected, he would be the first GOP candidate to win statewide office since 2006. He thinks he can beat the odds. Change is coming to California, Hilton said the day after the election. That is good news for everyone. The outcome means Democratic candidate Tom Steyer did not qualify for the November election. During the campaign, Hilton attacked Democrats over the state's high cost of living, the homelessness crisis, and other issues. He pledged to lower prices for everything from gas to housing, making Californians' first $100,000 free of income tax, create a loan program for first-time homebuyers, and freeze in-state tuition on public colleges. And the next article is, Plattner wins easily, shifts focus to Collins. And this is a Globe staff article. Graham Plattner, the combat veteran and oyster farmer virtually unknown outside this corner of Maine a year ago, officially clinched the Democratic nomination in the state's U.S. Senate primary election Tuesday night, according to the Associated Press. Though Plattner's meteoric political rise has been improbable, the outcome was a foregone conclusion as he faced minimal opposition after his only serious rival among Democrats, Governor Janet Mills, suspended her Senate campaign in April. But with Plattner rocketed by damaging allegations in recent weeks, his margin of victory will provide a measure of his political resilience. Mills' name was still on the primary ballot, and some Democrats here still withheld support despite Plattner's being the presumptive nominee. Pamela?
And going to the Metro section, fare-free bus routes set to run through the end of 2026, but cost of extending popular program unclear. Three MBTA bus routes will remain free to ride through the end of the year, Mayor Michelle Wu and the MBTA announced Tuesday, just weeks before the fare-free pilot program was again set to run out of funding. Spokespeople for the Wu administration and the transit agency did not immediately make clear Tuesday how much the program's temporary extension would cost. City and state officials indicated that money used for the MBTA's reduced fare program would cover the plan to temporarily extend the program for bus routes 23, 28, and 29, which go through Mattapan, Dorchester, and Roxbury. Wu's office in a statement that the reduced fare program resulted in cost savings that are being applied to deliver this extension through the end of the year. City officials also said that they plan on working in the summer and fall on options for the fare-free program in 2027. There's no such thing as free, said Brian Kane, executive director of the MBTA Advisory Board. It just means someone else is paying for it, and every trip on the MBTA is already significantly subsidized. Wu's office on Tuesday touted the program's success, saying riders have taken nearly 23,000 fare-free trips every weekday on the three bus routes since the start of the year. All-door boarding on the buses have cut times at stops by 20%, according to the city. We're proud to partner with the MBTA to extend the successful program as we continue building a more reliable, accessible, and affordable transportation system across Boston, Wu said in a statement. Wu first eliminated fares on the three bus routes in March 2022, when she used $8 million in federal pandemic relief dollars to fund the program. Then, in February 2024, Wu again used federal COVID-19 funds to reimburse the MBTA and continue the pilot program for an additional 2 years. That money was set out to run out at the end of February, but roughly a week before, city officials announced that enough of those funds remained to pay for the program through the end of this month. Transit advocates have fretted over the program's long-term future and from where officials could pull money to keep rides free on the three bus routes. Seth Gadbois, a transportation attorney for the Conservation Law Foundation, applauded the extension of this essential program. But, Gadbois said, it feels a little like we're driving in circles when it comes to long-term solutions. We bought 4 months of this back in February, and here we are buying 6 months more now, Gadbois said. Especially at a time when many transit advocates see the administration's commitment to climate safety and justice missing from the budget, this is a promising and important step, but riders need and deserve more long-term certainty. Reggie Ramos, the executive director of the nonprofit Transportation for Massachusetts, said she was not surprised officials want to extend the fare-free routes through the end of this year, calling it a wildly popular program that has proven to be a lifeline for that corridor. Beyond the extension of this program, the real and critical questions are, how do we make programs like this sustainable, and how do we ensure that the service these buses provide are at a level that's dignified and truly reliable, Ramos said in a statement. Transit advocates have pushed Wu and city officials to find a long-term, sustainable funding source to continue the program. In February, Wu's office said the city is discussing the future of the program with the MBTA. Supporters of the three fare-free routes have pointed to city statistics that show more than one quarter of riders on the routes save $20 or more per month, savings they can put towards other expenses. City Councilor Ruth Z. Lujan said the routes are used heavily by our working class and black and brown residents. We're helping families save money, making it easier for people to get to work, school, and other essential services, and continue to build a more equitable and connected city, he said in a statement provided by Wu's office. Karen?
Thanks, Pamela. Also from today's Metro section, Healy says she backs a happy hour local option, says it may be a way to attract, keep people here. On the heels of a swift effort from the state legislature to extend last call at bars to at least 3 a.m. this summer, Governor Maura Healy opined on another boozy topic that has long rankled Beacon Hill, lifting a ban on happy hour. Healy said on WEEI's The Greg Hill Show Tuesday that she personally supports happy hour, which allows for discounted prices on alcoholic drinks, but has been illegal in Massachusetts for decades. When asked if she could ever see happy hour making a return, she framed the idea as part of her competitiveness pitch to attract and retain more people in the state. I personally support happy hour. That said, it's a local option, Healy said. I really want 20-somethings, 18 to 35-year-olds, staying in Boston, staying in Massachusetts, and it's really important that we create spaces for them to hang out and socialize. But just 2 years ago, she sounded less sure when asked whether she supported the concept of bringing happy hour back. I think there are problems with that, to be honest, she said during a July 2024 appearance on GBH's Boston Public Radio. What I'm really focused on is not happy hour. A spokesperson for Healy declined further comment Tuesday. Governor Michael Dukakis first approved a proposal by alcohol regulators to outlaw happy hour in the 1980s after a 20-year-old Weymouth woman was killed in the parking lot of a Braintree bar after being dragged under a car driven by an intoxicated friend, according to a 1983 Patriot Ledger article about the incident. Newspapers at the time reported that the driver and her friend had left a trivia game at Ground Round in Braintree, where they received several free mugs of beer as prizes. The incident triggered a push to ban happy hour statewide, and in November 1984, Massachusetts became the first in the nation to ban happy hour drinking. The ban, still on the books, prohibits free drinks, jumbo-sized drinks, contests with drink prizes, and sales of pitchers of beer to solo customers. In the last decade or so, other states that had similar bans on happy hour have lifted restrictions, including Indiana, Illinois, and Kansas. State legislators here, however, are split on the issue. The Senate has twice passed legislation that would give local cities and towns the option to allow happy hour. The measure, however, has died in negotiations with the House, where Democratic leaders have not supported the idea. The Senate's push would have allowed any city or town to vote to allow the sale of discounted alcoholic beverages at bars and restaurants during specific hours. The local governments would then set their own regulations on how the rules would work. State Senator Julian Sears' effort is not the first time Beacon Hill has taken up the happy hour idea. Petitioners proposed the state put the question on the 2022 ballot, but supporters didn't gather enough signatures to get the language before voters. Sear, who sponsored the Senate's effort, said in expressing the governor's support, Healy is reiterating the perspective that we hear from scores of small business owners, our main streets and downtowns. I'm delighted, the Provincetown Democrat said. I think the opportunity to help get a little more foot traffic in the door is a real shot in the arm that our smallest businesses need. House Budget Chief Aaron Mikulicz, a North End Democrat, said his chamber hasn't supported the issue because of objections from the Massachusetts Restaurant Association, which represents about 1,800 restaurants. Steve Clark, president of the association, said Tuesday in a text that the governor's comments were more of an answer to a question rather than a comment on any imminent legislative change. Restaurateurs are divided on the topic, too. Some worry that happy hour prices could lead to a race to the bottom. Others, including hospitality industry veteran George Abajode, are all for it. The owner of Committee in the Seaport and Eva on Newbury Street said, "Hearing happy hour come up in discussion again feels like I'm in the twilight zone. I've asked for that for so long, and I've always been told it's never going to happen," he said. "I feel like I'm dreaming. I never expected to hear happy hour and 3 a.m. in this city." Pamela.
Pride Parade sign and display makers offer messages rooted in love. Stretching from Copley Square to Boston Common, a vibrant procession of floats, banners, and handmade signs transform the city streets into a celebration of visibility and self-expression for Boston's 56th annual Pride Parade on Saturday. Featuring the theme, Pride as Protest Since 1776, this year's festivities brought together creative and passionate residents to celebrate identity, resilience, and love while honoring the LGBTQ plus community's long history of activism. LGBTQ people have been around before and since 1776, said Adriana Boulin, president of Boston Pride for the People, during a press conference Friday in front of the Boston Public Library. "And it's because of their active courage and putting their lives on the line that allows us to have parades and to be visible. Every sign, fastened to a float, taped to a car, or raised above the crowd during Saturday's parade, told a story about personal experiences, identities, and histories of the people who carried them. Some delivered sharp political messages, while others offered humor or words of encouragement. Outside of the Capital One Cafe on Exeter Street, an hour before the parade began, Eric Weeks Page carefully assembled an eye-catching display, 2 15-foot-tall hands forming a heart around a multicolored centerpiece with the word love. Page, a nurse with Good Shepherd Community Care, a hospice care organization in Massachusetts, said he created the display in just one day using plywood. "Its simple message of love pays tribute to Good Shepherd's belief that everyone deserves compassionate care, regardless of who they are." Towering above the crowd at Copley Square, one participant was impossible to miss. Strapped to his back like the sails of a pirate ship were an array of bisexual pride flags emblazoned in pink, purple, and blue. "This started 4 years ago with my first pride," said Carter Chamberlain of Needham. "Every year, I add more flags to it." "One big challenge with bisexuality is visibility," he added. "A lot of people here are bisexual, so I'm holding this flag for every single one of them." In front of the Copley Station entrance sat a parade float dubbed the Gay Bus from our organizers Roxanne Campbell, Saul Ramos, and Alex Rivera-Ortiz. Filled with children from schools across Massachusetts, the school bus was decorated with signs created by members of the Massachusetts Teachers Association. The displays, including one of a rainbow high heel stomping to the word hate, were designed to counter hateful rhetoric and uplift students and educators in the LGBTQ plus community. "We want to make sure we're inclusive of everyone," Ramos said, "not just educators, but students and the community." For the organizers, transforming a familiar yellow school bus into a pride float was an easy choice because of the memories it evokes. "Every time someone sees it, they connect with it," Ramos said. "Last year, someone shouted, 'Oh my God, I rode a small school bus just like this when I was in school.'" Getting ready to ride near Trinity Church, a biker club helped lead the parade's final stretch. Strapped to the back of one of the motorcycles was a sign reading, "Healthcare, not warfare," along with Woodrow, a teddy bear dressed in leather and a rainbow tie. The bike belonged to Judy Thrasher, president of the Moving Violations Motorcycle Club, a women's motorcycle club that's led the Pride Parade for 41 years. Thrasher said the display is an amalgamation of material she's used in her participation in three different protests over the years. "One president of the club didn't want the bear, so I've been carrying it around ever since," Thrasher said of Woodrow. "She's always on the back." A little ways away, there were people holding posters and signs memorializing members of the transgender community who have been killed or lost to violence in 2025 and 2026 so far, according to attendee Deb Fitzgerald. Her sign bore the name Harvey James Ferris, a 19-year-old from Chenevis, New York, who died in 2025. "My fear only came from this potentially happening to my kid," said Fitzgerald, a mother of a trans son. No child should have to endure or be threatened in any kind of way. So for me, it's rooted in a mother's love. Karen?
Thanks, Pamela. Our next article is written by Globe food writer Devra First. Would you pay $30 for a sandwich? How much would you pay for pastrami? How much is too much to pay for a sandwich? $20? $30? At Samla Grosse's, a downtown institution since 1968, one of the famous pastrami sandwiches will run you anywhere from $26.95 to $31.95. Seems people are happy to pay for all these glorious beasts, heaped with smoky meat, with names like Pastrami Diablo and Pastrami Travelers. When the Globe magazine's Best of the Best awards came out in 2025, there was reader outcry that La Grosse's didn't make the list of best sandwich shops. The 2026 awards righted that. At Table Mercato in the North End, the sandwiches, towering cutlet-based constructions on thick slabs of focaccia, gooey chicken parm subs draped in vodka sauce, have gone viral. The $20 to $26 price tag doesn't stop consumers from lining up and waiting, and an outpost is opening in New York this summer. There are plenty of delicious sandwiches to be found in the Boston area for less than $20. Places like Banh Mi Ba Li in Dorchester, Billy's in the South End, Bob's in Medford, Cuddy's in Brookline, La Saison in Cambridge and Charlestown, New Deal in Revere, Square Deli in Everett, Tutto Italiano in Hyde Park, and, oh yeah, that place you love best are some that come immediately to mind. Even at Al Antico Veneto, the viral Italian sandwich shop that opened in Back Bay last year, the sandwiches are $15 to $21. Hardly cheap, but far from $30. But the days of the sandwich as a symbol of affordability, the kind of thing you grab without thinking about it, may be behind us in these parts. A report from Toast, the Boston-based restaurant point of sale and management system, found that sandwich prices in Massachusetts were up 4% year over year as of June 2024. And in April 2026, average wholesale food prices were 35% more than in February 2020, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Gulp. It doesn't bode well for the widespread return of the under $10 sandwich. So, can a $30 sandwich be worth it? How about a $26 sandwich? Let's find out. On a recent Wednesday afternoon, I trot down to Samla Grosse's to pick up a Chipotle pastrami sandwich for $30.95. There are many enticing pastrami options from which to choose, but this is one of the shop's best known, best love variations, a grilled Italian sesame roll piled with pastrami, of course, chipotle honey mustard, coleslaw, and Swiss cheese. I bring it back to the office, where I find a hungry colleague staring sadly at his desk. Would you like half a pastrami sandwich, I ask. My share is still plenty big, and now it costs only $15.48. We eat. Somehow, I have never had a sandwich from Samla Grosse's before, and I see that this has been a terrible oversight. The pastrami is incredible, rich but not fatty, satisfying but not heavy. Chipotle honey mustard sounded a little busy, but it works. Spicy, sweet, and pungent. That and the coleslaw are a foil for the pastrami and Swiss. The bread is no afterthought. It ups the game. I'd like to say it whisks me back to the Jewish delis of my youth, a Prostian Madeline experience, but it doesn't. It's different. It's its own great thing. And that's all the time we have left for today's reading of the Boston Globe. This is Karen
and Pamela
thanking all of you so much for joining us today.